This is your strategic briefing for today. I'm tracking a significant escalation in Western economic warfare that could fundamentally reshape the entire conflict landscape within the next 6 to 18 months. Let me start with what happened this week that changes everything. France seized a tanker called the Grinch in the English Channel. Now, on the surface, this might sound like routine sanctions enforcement, but the strategic calculus here is far more sophisticated than it appears. This isn't just one ship. This is the opening move in what could become the systematic dismantling of Russia's entire shadow fleet, roughly 600 vessels moving approximately 5 million barrels per day of sanctioned oil. What makes this particularly significant is the coordination we're observing. France provides the military enforcement capability, operating in one of the world's most critical maritime choke points. Simultaneously, a company called Global Maritime Services filed an application with the U.S. Office of Foreign Assets Control, OFAC, laying out detailed plans for mass vessel seizures and dismantlement over a six-month timeline. This level of institutional preparation tells us this isn't reactive enforcement. This is strategic planning that's been months in development. Think about the geography of power here. Western nations control the critical maritime choke points that matter. The English Channel, the Skagerrak Straits between Denmark and Norway, and through NATO ally Turkey, the Turkish Straits connecting the Black Sea to the Mediterranean. Once the political decision is made to act, interdiction becomes relatively straightforward. The infrastructure is already in place. What we're witnessing now is political will crystallizing into operational capability. The timing of this action reveals something crucial about Western confidence levels. They believe they have alternative supply arrangements secured, and they're willing to accept short-term market disruption for long-term strategic gains. Removing this transport capacity would severely constrain both Russian and Iranian exports. We're talking about the potential for significant energy price volatility, but more importantly, a fundamental reshaping of global oil trade routes that's been developing since sanctions began. Now, let me connect this to the broader economic picture facing Russia, because multiple pressure points are converging simultaneously. Russian banks are facing liquidity crises that require daily repo loan interventions from the central bank just to maintain basic functionality. Toxic loan rates have hit 28%. The government is extracting resources to fund military operations at an unsustainable pace, creating debt cycles that provide zero economic return because war material doesn't generate productive economic activity. Here's what concerns me most from an analytical standpoint. Intelligence assessments suggest Russia has perhaps 2,000 tanks remaining in reserve. Missiles are being used immediately upon production. This indicates resource depletion that's simply incompatible with prolonged warfare at current intensity levels. The Russian economy is burning through its foundation. And here's where the shadow fleet seizures become strategically decisive. Insurance costs for these vessels already consume between 26 and 76% of oil profits. Now add potential sanctions on refineries in China, India, and Turkey, the primary destinations for this oil, and you're looking at the elimination of Russia's estimated $1 billion in daily oil revenue. That's the financial engine sustaining military operations. The French enforcement action isn't happening in isolation. It's happening precisely as these economic vulnerabilities reach critical mass. But there's a deeper problem with Russia's decision-making calculus that makes this situation particularly dangerous. 26 family members occupy senior government roles, all profiting directly from this conflict. This creates perverse incentives where military objectives become secondary to familial enrichment and regime survival. Military analysts estimate Russia would need approximately 1 million additional casualties just to capture the remaining territory in Donbass that they claim as objectives. That's strategically unattainable. Yet the political necessity of continuing the conflict, driven by domestic power consolidation and personal enrichment, creates a fundamental disconnect between strategic reality and political behavior. This is why the current negotiation theater we're seeing is so revealing. Russian state television explicitly rejects any meaningful compromise, while simultaneously participating in UAE-mediated talks in Abu Dhabi. They're demanding complete Ukrainian withdrawal from Donbass, territory Ukraine currently holds, while celebrating attacks on civilian infrastructure. Russian propagandists are now openly threatening conventional strikes on European decision centers, followed by potential nuclear escalation. Notice how the threat envelope has expanded beyond Ukraine to include NATO territories directly. These are Soviet-era stalling tactics, seeking territorial gains through negotiation that are unachievable militarily, while running down the clock on economic collapse. The strategic question becomes, what happens when that clock runs out?
This brings us to the scenario analysis that matters. Russia faces two fundamental paths forward. First, economic collapse within 6 to 18 months, as these converging pressures overwhelm the system's capacity to adapt. Or second, escalation designed to force a negotiated settlement before that timeline completes. The latter path substantially increases European security risks, which is why France's positioning on this becomes strategically significant. Paris is pursuing what I'd characterize as strategic autonomy with contingency planning. They're maintaining firm Ukraine support. Europe has provided a 90 billion euro weapons credit line, dwarfing American contributions at this point, but they're also advocating for direct European-Russian communication channels. This isn't appeasement. This is recognition that Europe may need independent diplomatic architecture that doesn't rely on American engagement. And this is where internal European debates become revealing. There's sharp disagreement over British participation in European defense frameworks post-Brexit. France demands UK financial contributions before inclusion. Germany, Poland, and the Netherlands favor more inclusive approaches. These aren't just bureaucratic turf battles. These are competing visions of European security architecture for the next generation, playing out in real time as the Russian threat evolves. Estonia issued a warning last week that deserves more attention than it received. They estimate 1.5 million Russian war veterans will emerge from this conflict, many with combat experience and grievances, potentially conducting hybrid operations across Europe for decades after any ceasefire. The conflict isn't ending with territorial resolution. It's evolving into sustained hybrid warfare that will affect European security calculations long after the shooting stops. Meanwhile, Ukraine is already pivoting towards alternative infrastructure partnerships. Their energy cooperation agreements with Romania indicate regional realignment that could reshape European energy security arrangements. But there's a concerning data point here about civilian resilience. Kyiv has over 500 buildings experiencing heating crises, even when there are no active strikes happening. This reveals structural vulnerabilities with implications for long-term civilian population sustainability and potential refugee flows into European territories. Now I want to shift to American institutional dynamics because there's a pattern emerging that affects strategic competitiveness in ways that matter geopolitically. Peter Thiel's experience with Palantir exposes something systemic about U.S. government procurement dysfunction, a demonstrably superior counterterrorism technology, with internal government reports showing its superiority, faced decade-long institutional resistance. Success required unprecedented legal action under a 1994 procurement law. SpaceX had to follow the same template to break through similar barriers. This isn't just about one company or one technology. This reveals how regulatory capture by incumbent defense contractors creates strategic vulnerabilities and innovation bottlenecks, while authoritarian competitors, particularly China, implement technological advances more rapidly. Democratic systems are struggling to adapt to technological change and maintain institutional effectiveness at the pace required for strategic competition. And this connects to domestic political debates in ways that compound the problem. There's momentum building around comprehensive immigration restriction, including proposed legislation to pause H-1B visas. The debate has escalated to include unsubstantiated allegations about federal agencies and extremist infiltration, claims with evidentiary foundation that nonetheless shape political discourse and policy formation. The strategic implication here is that policy effectiveness deteriorates, democratic governance mechanisms weaken, and international perception of American institutional capacity declines. This affects ally management and deterrence credibility in tangible ways. When your allies question whether you can execute coherent long-term strategy because of domestic dysfunction, that changes their calculus about dependence on American security guarantees. Let me close with two cases that illuminate how governance gaps create exploitable spaces with geopolitical ramifications. In the Amazon basin, uncontacted tribes are now seeking outside help because narco-traffickers, illegal loggers, and gold miners operate with complete impunity in territories where state capacity doesn't reach effectively. The Amazon contains 20% of global freshwater and oxygen production. Its protection isn't a local environmental issue, it's a global security matter. The tribes are asking how to distinguish good guys from bad guys when they encounter outsiders. That question reveals the complexity of power dynamics in spaces where traditional state mechanisms simply don't function. Hybrid approaches combining local knowledge, international funding, and community-based governance are filling gaps, but these informal arrangements create jurisdictional ambiguities that criminal networks actively exploit. The second case involves what independent investigations have revealed about Epstein's New Mexico ranch. Unlike his other properties, this location was never raided by law enforcement. The property's strategic isolation, surrounded entirely by politically connected landownership, and evidence of continued meetings with intelligence officials even post-conviction, suggest sophisticated protection networks operating in jurisdictional gaps. Both cases demonstrate the same pattern. Powerful actors, whether criminal networks or politically connected elites, exploit governance gaps to operate beyond accountability mechanisms. These ungoverned spaces enable activities with systemic implications that extend far beyond the immediate locations. environmental degradation affecting global climate systems, organized crime threatening regional stability, elite impunity undermining institutional legitimacy that's foundational to democratic governance. So here's your signal to monitor over the next 48 hours. Watch for Russian responses to the French Shadow Fleet seizure. Will they retaliate through cyber attacks on Western energy infrastructure? Will we see manipulation of Arctic shipping routes? Or will they accelerate partnerships with Chinese and Indian shipping networks to create alternative transportation systems beyond Western interdiction capability? The response pattern will tell us how much strategic runway they believe they have left. Stay vigilant. Until tomorrow.